I could be close to it all and all, if I could be close to it all. If I had my dream, it would not fall down. If I could live high on the ground, the sound of high is a good one to many around when they want to be close to it all. Close to it all in all, I gotta be close to it all. The Village Sugar Takers, Madison Avenue Pink Dream Makers, they try to escape from it all, but instead they build walls, that's all. Be close to it all. If I had my dream, I would fill a hall, tell all the people tear down the wall that keeps them from being a part of it all, 'cause they gotta be close to it all. Sugar takers, the Avenue Pink Dream Makers, they try to escape from it all, but instead they build walls, that's all. They want to be close to it all. There's just one more thing that I want to say. Everyone's got their own special way that keeps them from getting too close to the day. Accept and be part of it all in all. And everyone, you gotta tear down all of your walls that keep you from being a part of it all. 'Cause you gotta be one with the one in all. And everyone, you gotta tear down all of your walls that keep you from being a part of it all. 'Cause you gotta be one with the one and all. You gotta be close to it all.
That was Melanie from the album Leftover Wine, which was recorded live at Carnegie Hall many, many moons ago. And before that, a piece called See My Wings Shining by Kay Gardner from the album A Rainbow Path. That was the instrumental. Before that, Sandy Denny from Sandy called Listen, Listen. 6:15 on a Sunday morning, Bastille Day, 1991. You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and the name of the show is Heresy. And that was the first reading in a series that I will be doing through August of feminist fairy tales, or fairy tales, stories, folk tales, whatever, by women writers. And that was called The Princess Who Stood on Her Own Two Feet. And it was written by Jean, come now, where is it? Looking it up. Jean Desi, D-E-S-Y. It's in a book called Don't Bet on the Prince, Contemporary Feminist Fairy Tales in North America and England, edited by Jack Zipes, a man horrors of all things. And it's a really very good book. It's put out by Methuen Incorporated, M-E-T-H-U-E-N, Inc. I've never heard of them, but they published this book anyway. And where did I find this? Take me back. Oh, I've got the price tag. I actually paid full price for this. It's one of the rare ones. I got this at Shakespeare and Company up on Broadway and 80-something Street. But they do a very, a caveat to people who go up there, they do a very month-by-month exhibit of books. They do a very topical exhibit, and I think I got this during June, which was Gay Pride Month. They had a lot of feminist books and books by gay male writers, but they might have it anyway. Zipes, Z-I-P-E-S, is the gentleman's last name who edited the book. Now, next I have two stories that go, in my warped and twisted mind, together. They are both about the incompatibility of merfolk, folk who live in the water, and land folk, folk who live on the land. Of course, we all know Hans Christian Andersen's and Disney's fairly feisty remake of The Little Mermaid. Hans Christian Andersen's being a bit more sacrificial and dogmatic, but The Little Mermaid's a pretty decent movie, and you should go out and rent it if you haven't seen it. Very catchy and sort of fun. Anyway, this story is, again, from Don't Bet on the Prince, and it's called Rusalka, or The Sea Coast of Bohemia, and it's by Joanna Russ. I'll be reading more Joanna Russ as I go along here on the show, just because she happens to be a favorite of mine. She's not for everybody. She's part of that new wave of science fiction and fantasy that appeared back in the early 70s. Samuel R. Delaney was part of that, and a few others. He's the one that comes to mind. But she's done some wonderful things, and this is called Rusalka, or The Seacoast of Bohemia. Rusalka might be alive today, the book said, if she had lived in the deep sea. But the Bay of Bohemia is a backwater with only a small community of sea people in it, and life is easy and pleasant, and it was there that Rusalka was born. She was a sea girl, or mermaid, as they're called. The sea folk don't have fish tails, as some stories tell you, but look very like people, with cold blood and webs between their fingers, with flat webbed feet and gills and pale green skins and flat noses, and with glaucous eyes with an extra eyelid under the usual ones, which comes up like a film and covers their eyes when they want it to. Glaucous means iridescent, like mother of pearl. This is what Rusalka looked like. She was an heiress among the sea folk, and this made her an awful snob. She would never leave gifts for a mer youth who had pleased her, because none of them pleased her, and she stuck her flat nose up at old mer matrons' wisdoms, and was rude to the old mer gentlemen when they told her they remembered her handsome father, who had been dead for years, so had her mother, in fact. She only said, "Nonsense." Then she began to read books, and that was fatal. In the deep sea, this would have brought no harm, for they have their own books there, and the sea colleges and sea laboratories and sea universities, and she could have become anything she liked. But the sea people in the Bay of Bohemia are pleasant and dull and don't write books, so Rusalka read land books and began to daydream about the land. Nobody knew where the books came from. Either they had fallen off a boat or come down with a drowned human family. But once Rusalka began to read them, she became more impossible than ever. She despised the sea people and everything in the sea. When the mer-youths and mermaids came in the mornings asking her to go picking sea grapes with them or minding the sea cattle, she wouldn't. And when they told jokes and stories, she was always somewhere else. In the deep sea, they would have known at once what was happening to her and would have sent her off to negotiate treaties with the great whales or chart the cold currents in the abyssal depths where there's hardly anything to breathe, even for the sea folk, and the cold makes them sluggish and it's dark and perilous. But the Bay of Bohemia was warm and shallow and life was dull, so Rusalka became a romantic. She would gaze all day from beneath the water at the sun, which looks from below like a wavering flower on top of the waves. We expect people who get like this to look at the moon a lot and so call it mooning, but the sea folk call it sunning. She also spent hours looking at the skeletons of drowned humans that the sea people had set up in a graveyard, surrounded by pretty plantings of sea anemones, which look like flowers but are really animals, and sea kelp. If we fall into their element, the sea people are sorry for us and carry us to land when they can, or push us up into the air so we can breathe. But after we're drowned, there's nothing they can do. Rusalka thought that the skeletons, even without their flesh, were handsomer than her own people. She read her books over and over again to memorize them before they could rot. One was a book of fairy tales, and one was Captain's Capex Guide to Coastal Navigation, which she didn't understand at all. She daydreamed about love, but not about youths of her own nation, for she had conceived a prejudice against green skins, flat noses and webbed hands and feet. She daydreamed about landmen. In short, nothing would do for Rusalka but a human lover with white skin and yellow hair. Then one day, the Prince of Bohemia rode along the edge of the beach with his retinue behind him, and Rusalka saw him. She had met her fate. Some say it was the banners and splendid trappings on the horses and that Rusalka was ambitious, but don't you believe it. It was worse than that. She had caught the human disease, which is wanting what you can't have, and at bottom despised her own kind. She was a daring and stubborn girl. She thought about the prince for a day, then buried her books in the ooze at the sea bottom, sold her sea cattle and her family's lands, and with the wealth in both hands, sea folk use shells for money, she went to bargain with the great sea witch. "Make me a human girl," she said. The sea witch refused. She was stooped, an old, blunt-spoken woman, and told Rusalka that she was being a fool. She offered to send her to the Finnish coast to learn magic, to Labrador to be an explorer, to the university on the edge of the great Pacific Trench where they study everything and one can meet merfolk from every nation. Rusalka said, "I shall throw myself on the sand and die at his feet," for the sea people drown in air just as we do in water. "By bottom, child," said the old witch, swearing by the sea bottom as we do by the sky when we say by heaven. "All this for a freakish monster you've seen once and whose body you've never even touched." But Rusalka was determined. As the old sea witch said, she was afire with love and something worse. For the fire of the body can be quenched with a pleasant person, and the fire of the heart with a dear friend. But the fire of the imagination is the very devil. And the end of it was that the old mermaidron had to agree and tell Rusalka what to do and when. And the witch told her what to do if she wanted to change back, but she must do it near the sea and jump in at once, or she would drown in the air. It was all titration, distillation, radiation, hydration, and oxidation, for the person you and I called an old witch was really a distinguished scientist. But she refused to take the shells, telling Rusalka to put them in the bank or lend them to someone, for she would need them when she got tired of that bleach-faced ninny, as the sea witch called the prince, and came back to the sea. So Rusalka did it. Most of it was boring, and she had to write it down on sea paper to remember it. The ingredients took her a whole week to get, and putting them together took the better part of a day. She did it in the shallows, so as not to drown either way, and when it was over, she stood on the sand of the beach in the horrible, bright emptiness of the air, tired, feeling dreadfully heavy because she was out of the water, and shaky with hunger. The witch had given her human feet to walk on, lungs to breathe air. Her gills and webs were gone, and her shape was somewhat changed. But Rusalka's skin was still pale, her blood was still cold, and her long hair was still pale green. There was a limit to what the witch could do. Also, she still had her extra eyelids, her features were flat and slanted, and she smelled of salt water. But, by the Bohemian standards of the land, she was a pretty woman. She walked toward the prince's castle, which stood on a promontory overlooking the sea. It wasn't far, but Rusalka was faint with hunger, and the chill of the night was coming on, which always makes the sea folk clumsy and slow. She tried to catch mice for food, but her fingers were too slow and her body heavy with being out of the water. Sometimes she walked, and sometimes she tried to run. On the last part of her trip, she got down on her hands and knees and crawled. So it was past midnight when a strange, beautiful, naked woman, dressed in nothing but her own long green hair, walked into the courtyard of the castle and fainted dead away on the stones. Of course, the prince took a fancy to her at once. She was good-looking, and she had appeared out of the night in a romantically mysterious way. Perhaps he had a touch of the same disease as Rusalka and loved anything exotic and different. And different she remained, since her voice, made for the thick sea, hurt her so badly in the thin, empty air that she was forced to be silent. She kept trying to write, "I am a sea maid who did this for love of you," on pieces of paper, but nobody in the castle could read. Having your feet hurt when you walk is nothing compared to losing your voice, and writing notes that nobody can read and nobody cares about. But it all seemed worth it when she heard the prince say that he had fallen in love with the strange princess. He supposed her to be royal like himself, and that he intended to marry her. They were married within the week. Rusalka was dressed in a landlady's dress, with white fur around the neck and pearls sewn over the white satin skirt, and the prince had an entire wardrobe sewn for her, of white or pale green dresses, so she would always look like a mermaid or a snow angel. It's customary in telling this kind of story to describe the prince and the princess's first kiss on their wedding night, if not the entire lovemaking. So I will tell you that as soon as the lovers were left alone in the splendid bridal chamber, they did kiss, and they expected it to be grand and beautiful. It wasn't. To him, she felt cold and slimy. To her, he felt hot and rough. Each of them smelled wrong. He almost let go of her when he saw her third eyelid slide up. He tried to go on making love, for he was a good-hearted and kindly man, and she was, after all, his bride, whom he had chosen. But he couldn't. He was perplexed and unhappy. Rusalka scribbled endless notes which he couldn't read and which the chambermaid swept up the next day. Things got worse. It remained unnerving to him to see her eyes turn into blank pearls, which happened whenever she was tired or bored or thinking. Her habit of dining on cold fish, for anything cooked or hot, nauseated her, upset him. The way she slowed down and became almost motionless after sunset terrified him. And as for Rusalka herself, her fine clothes itched intolerably, her skirts weighed too much, and staying indoors in one place and doing embroidery bored her horribly. She would wait for the prince all day among her ladies' maids, whose coarse skins and hot smell repelled her and whose chatter was loathsome. And when he came, the fire of love that had been in her heart for him all day would die. She tried to remember how she felt when she'd glimpsed him from under the sea, but it was no good. And then when he wasn't there, it would all come back to her, and she would love him passionately. Some stories say at this point the prince turned his affections to a woman of his own people, but that's not true. He was still trying to love Rusalka because he felt that he ought to, and besides, he was good-hearted. As for Rusalka, she hadn't any other friend in the castle than he. The court ladies were too terrified of her to make friends, and she hated to admit that she'd been wrong. So they kept trying. Besides, closer acquaintance had made them feel the beginnings of something else for each other. A distant courtesy, a careful politeness, a puzzled and despairing pity, as you'd feel towards anyone in trouble. Then one day the prince saw his beautiful, pale bride sitting in a courtyard of the castle near an ornamental pond full of goldfish. She liked to sit there because the pond reminded her of the sea, but nobody knew this. She looked sad and drooping, and he remembered how she had appeared out of the night only a few weeks ago. His heart was moved. Then this lovely, sad lady in her shimmering, pale green satin gown dipped her ermine-trimmed sleeve in the pond, caught a goldfish with her bare hand, and ate it raw. Well, you can imagine what the prince felt. He wanted very badly to get rid of Rusalka and never see her again. But he was an honorable man and had bound himself to her in marriage. Then a solution came to him, a beautiful and simple idea, although it was wrong, as many beautiful and simple ideas are. and it consoled him wonderfully. She was under a spell. He was right, of course, although he'd gotten it all backwards. Rusalka's paleness, her sluggishness in the cold, her slippery skin, her odd smell, and her strange eating habits, these were not the work of enchantment, as the prince thought, but the only things left about her that were natural. The enchantment was all the other way. But the prince thought he could transform her into a lovely human bride, and in the joy of this discovery, he sent post-haste for the court wizard. That wizard felt Rusalka's pulse, tapped her knees, looked down her throat, peered into her eyes, and counted her teeth. Then he pronounced a mighty spell over her.